In 1988, PBS aired a six-hour series of conversations between Bill Moyers and Joseph Campbell called The Power of Myth that caught the public imagination. How many of you watched The Power of Myth?
Yes.
And are otherwise familiar with Joseph Campbell? Awesome. Oh, now the pressure's on. I had always been curious about the show and finally had the chance to watch it on Netflix about a year ago, which only made me want to read Campbell's books and listen to his lectures. And that's why I want to thank Loudoun County Transit for making this sermon possible. This opportunity to listen to his lectures finally arose when I started a new job in Roslyn last April and found myself with 2 hours of quiet time because this bus is quiet. Each day, commuting back and forth by bus between the Sicklin Road Park and Ride and Roslyn. So for the last few months, I'm sorry to tell you all, I've listened to all of Campbell's lectures since the 1960s and also read quite a few of his most popular books. Today, I'm hoping to adequately convey some of his encyclopedic knowledge about worldwide myths and why they're relevant to us today, while also drawing on the work of some other great thinkers whose insights dovetail with his. So Joseph Campbell taught comparative mythology and comparative religion at Sarah Lawrence College for 40 years.
I heard it twice.
Oh my gosh, stop the sermon. No, no. God willing, you're going to see some of him in a few minutes, but that's super exciting. He taught there for almost 40 years. I won't want to say, Carol, that he started in 1934, so people are going to do the math. But distinguishing between mythology and religion defies his teaching. To Campbell, mythology is simply other people's religions, and vice versa. And that is his teaching right there. If you want to understand what your own religion is trying to tell you, he says, read other people's myths, go to other people's churches and mosques, and let the symbols speak to you. When you read your own religious texts, you tend to interpret them factually and you miss the messages. So here's how Campbell explains his central ideas in his own words. Get ready for this, Carol already knows. When you watch his videos or listens to his lectures, Campbell is an unlikely messenger of world truths. He speaks with a heavy New York accent that reminds me of my Uncle Joe, who was the Dean of Philosophy at Hofstra University for more than 30 years. All right. Here's a clip from The Power of Myth with the journalist Bill Moyers asking the question.
First answer would be, well, John, live your life. It's a good life. You don't need this. I don't believe in being interested in subjects because they're said to be important and interesting. I believe in being caught by it somehow or other. But you may find that with a proper introduction, this subject will catch you. And so what can it do for you when it does catch you? These bits of information from ancient times, which have to do with the themes that have supported man's life, built civilizations, informed religions over the millennia, have to do with deep inner problems, inner mysteries, inner thresholds of passage. And if you don't know what the guide signs are along the way, you have to work it out yourself. But once this captures you, there is always such a feeling from one or another of these traditions of information of a deep, rich, life-vivifying sort that you want to give it up.
So myths are stories of the search by men and women.
Sorry, guys.
For
yeah, I thought I did.
Meaning, for significance.
Not stopping.
To make life signifying.
Thank you. Well, you wanted it to go on, right?
Yeah.
So that was a trick to pick a 90-second clip out of all of his teachings. So is it just me, or is this guy onto something? It gets better from there, as Campbell explains that the role of myth is not to instruct us on the meaning of life, but rather on how to experience the divine here and now. Ancient myths were designed to harmonize the individual's mind and body so that he or she could be harmonized with their society and with nature. That's no small task, and something Campbell believed the great myths can still do for us today. Through his research and travels, Campbell came to see, like Carl Jung before him, that myths and the symbols they use are fundamentally the same the world over. Why? Because the human psyche is fundamentally the same the world over. Regardless of our place and time in this dimension, our psyches share the same instincts, impulses, conflicts, and fears. I would argue that between globalization and drastically accelerating rates of change in the current internet age, our ancient psyches are actively being rewired in possibly dangerous ways, but I promise to save that for another day. Out of this common psyche have come what Jung called archetypes, which are the common ideas of myths. These archetypes appear under different guises in different societies, based on environmental and historical conditions. As myths, the great religions all hold archetypal truths and shouldn't be discounted. It's the inevitable societal and political forces that distort their meaning and do so much damage. That's me, actually. As we know, the religion that you grew up with has an outsized effect on you. For example, Judaism and Christianity are based in dualities. Good and evil, heaven and hell, guilt and innocence, sin and atonement. Beginning with the fall in the Garden of Eden, nature is corrupt, and we are separated from both nature and God. Because nature is corrupt, every spontaneous act is sinful and must not be yielded to. Contrast that with Eastern religions, in which nature is the manifestation of divinity and the spirit is the revelation of that divinity inherent in ourselves. Imagine growing up under that tradition instead, without the burden of sin or guilt or alienation from God. But here's the rub. Even if you now embrace Eastern philosophy or other religions under the UU umbrella, represented by the symbols overhead, it can be hard to shake the religion you grew up with, especially if you still swim in it every day. I confess that often to help me fall asleep, I say the Lord's Prayer, which immediately evokes the image of the bearded Father who art in heaven. It's a constant reminder to me that I can think I've let something go that I no longer believe in, but have I really? Campbell believed that in the end, there is only one great myth, the hero's journey, that we must all embark on. Outside of the power of myth television series, he's best known for his book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, wherein he discusses his theory of the archetypal hero's journey shared by world mythologies. George Lucas credited this book as influencing his Star Wars saga. And some of the conversations between Moyers and Campbell for The Power of Myth were filmed at Lucas's Skywalker Ranch in Marin County, California. In the West, myths about the archetypal hero's journey include the King Arthur legend, the Odyssey, and even Don Quixote. More recently, in addition to Star Wars, we have Indiana Jones, Harry Potter, Game of Thrones, not to mention the Chronicles of Narnia and the Lord of the Rings. Out of sheer ignorance, I'm not even touching on video games that must be rife with heroes' journeys to be played out by gamers around the world. So these stories are everywhere in popular culture. The hero's journey is the old story of the spiritual quest. Although it's spiritual, the hero's sphere of action is the here and now. And at least in the West, it's the battle between good and evil, the stuff of books and movies. The typical sequence of actions involves trials that bring forth revelations that change the hero's understanding of life. From that starting point, there are many variations. First, there are two types of deed. One is the physical deed, in which the hero performs a courageous act. The adventure begins with someone from whom something has been taken. This person then takes off on a series of adventures beyond the ordinary, either to recover what has been lost or to discover something new. It's usually a cycle, a going and a returning. There may be a descent into darkness, such as Jonah descending into the belly of the whale. There may be an encounter with the dark power, such as St. George slaying the dragon. The other kind of journey is the spiritual deed, in which the hero experiences the supernatural and returns with a message. These deeds are found in a type of myth called the vision quest, wherein the hero leaves the world that they've lived in and descends into a depth, travels a distance, or ascends to a height to find what was missing in the world they left. After the vision quest, the trick is to hold on to that new wisdom upon your return, and that is not an easy thing to do. The archetypal heroes of the vision quest are the founders of the great religions. The Buddha went into solitude and sat beneath the tree of immortal knowledge, where he received an illumination. Jesus went into the desert for 40 days and came out with a message. Moses went to the top of the mountain and came down with the Ten Commandments, and so on. In another twist of the hero's journey, there are two kinds of heroes, those that choose to undertake the journey and those that don't. In the first kind of journey, the hero sets out intentionally to perform the deed. In the second, the hero is thrown into the adventure, such as being drafted into the army. Lastly, the hero's journey is embodied in coming-of-age rituals, whether they be catechisms or bar or bat mitzvahs, or the initiation rites of indigenous societies, through which a child ceremoniously becomes an adult. And again, coming-of-age stories are everywhere in popular culture. Though literally epic in proportion, the great myths represent the trials and revelations that each of us is bound to encounter on our own journey. But how are we as individuals supposed to find our hero's journey and embark on it? And what if we're already on it and we have no idea? Myths can provide the clues we're looking for by helping us recognize our own lives in their meaning. Campbell believed that one of the basic functions of myth is to provide a sort of travel guide for us to reach fulfillment, or what he calls bliss. And here's a quote from The Power of Myth. If you follow your bliss, you put yourself on a kind of track that has been there all the while waiting for you. And the life that you ought to be living becomes the one you are living. When you can see that, you begin to meet people who are in your field of your bliss, and they open doors for you. I say, follow your bliss, and don't be afraid, and doors will open where you didn't know they were going to be. Do those words from an academic scholar sound eerily similar to the Mountaineer's quote that Graham read earlier? Good, they're supposed to. A less rosy variation on this theme comes from Friedrich Nietzsche in the late 1800s, who urged us toward amor fati, or love of your fate, which is to say, embrace your fate as your hero's journey. As Campbell says, it is your fate and yours alone. You will have to work it out for yourself, taking your clues from here and there, and perhaps from the great myths, or perhaps from your UU brethren. That's not Campbell either. His advice perfectly embodies two of our UUA principles. Number 4, which promotes a free and responsible search for truth and meaning across cultures and belief systems. And number 7, which is respect for the interdependent web of all existence, as evidenced in the recurring archetypes across world mythologies throughout time. Speaking for myself, I like the idea that myths and their symbols can help me understand that I am on my own hero's journey. I like believing that the trials and misfortunes that have often defined my life are part of a hero's journey, one on which I can prevail, and not just bad luck. My journey's starting point is clear to me. It began in 1982 when I was a sophomore in college, and I had my first bout of major depression, something that wasn't diagnosed as bipolar disorder until I was 40. The havoc this condition has wreaked on my life is a story I've shared here before, so I won't go through that again, except to say that lately, I'm struggling with the notion of amor fati. The Murray quote that Graham read earlier sits on my bookshelf. The quote, albeit attributed to Goethe at the time, was given to me by a patient whom I befriended in a psych ward in New Jersey in 1983, and I have kept it within reach for these past 36 years, especially when I find myself beginning a new leg of my journey. Recently, I've come to rely on another kindred spirit to help me on my journey, the English poet and philosopher David White. David White? Love David White? If you're not familiar with him, I encourage you to listen to his conversations with Krista Tippett in her On Being podcasts, or to watch his TED Talks, or to read his books of poetry. I had the privilege of hearing him speak at a conference years ago, and his trance-like incantations are mesmerizing. This poem is called Just Beyond Yourself.
This is called, this is a piece from the same unpublished book called Just Beyond Yourself. Just beyond yourself, it's where you need to be. Just beyond yourself, it's where you need to be. Half a step into self-forgetting, and the rest restored by what you'll need. Just beyond yourself, it's where you need to be. Half a step into self-forgetting, and the rest restored by what you'll meet. There's a road always beckoning. There's a road always beckoning. When you see the two sides of it closing together at that far horizon, and deep in the foundations of your own heart at exactly the same time, that's how you know it's the way you have to go. That's how you know it's the road you have to follow. That's how you know. It's just beyond yourself. It's where you need to be.
Blessed be.